those searchlights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Hello, I'm Herb, and welcome to Community Spotlight. Each week I have somebody into the station to talk about their journey or a community organisation who are having an event. And today I've got Rod Ferris. Good morning, Rod.
Good morning.
How are we?
Oh, cold, warming up.
Yeah, cold. It was a bit of a cold morning this morning, but that's Armidale, a bit of a frost and a bit of fog. Now, tell me, you're an Armidale local?
Born in Armidale, well, I lived up until I was married out at Somers Ponds on the property out there. Father and brother had it together.
So you tell me that your family came to Armidale in 1863.
That's right. They came out in 1863 and settled it out at Somers Ponds. He had six children altogether, but three of them from his first wife and then three from his present wife at the time. So my great-great-grandfather was one of his eldest children that came out from his first wife.
So they were free settlers, they weren't convicts?
Oh no, they weren't convicts.
They were free settlers. We've got something in common there. And you went to school. There was a couple of schools out at Saumarez Ponds.
Oh well, yes, there was a school that Dad went to opposite the St Nicholas Church. There was a school there. Another one up at Eversley, that's further out. There was the other one on the Demerick Dam Road, only a few hundred yards up from where you turn on the Demerick Dam Road. They closed the other two and put on a bus which was owned by the Education Department, and it was housed at the other school. That was before my time. It was an old bean bus.
So was it one of the first buses in New South Wales to take kids?
It was the first free school bus. First school bus owned by the Education Department.
And you came to Demerick School as primary school?
That's it, and that's the one that's just
down the road here. That's the museum now.
Yes.
What was school time like back then?
Oh, it was fairly hard. I was a bit sickly, I think, when I was young. I was looking at some of my old school reports and I'd missed out 30 days in the year not attending school. And it wasn't because I wagged it, because we used to have to walk half a mile to the picked up by the bus. I think I had a lot of health problems when I was young.
So how many teachers were in the Jumeirah
school?
There
was only ever one at that time. Earlier there'd been two teachers there. There was only one when I was there. And the first teacher, actually, I was there, had a lot of trouble with him and he got sacked. And
you went to Armidale High then after that?
Yeah, that's right, yes.
For 3 years, and you've got your intermediate leaving certificate?
Oh, no, intermediate they call. You had to go on to year five to get the leaving certificate.
Right.
Yeah.
The intermediate certificate. And you went to an apprenticeship?
I went to an apprenticeship at Woodward and Perkis in Armidale.
Whereabouts were they?
On the corner of Marsh and Demerick Street. But Woodward and Perkis was a much bigger building than that, right up until Woodward Lane. If you go up Marsh Street, they had a big business there with cars and retreading business, tyre retreading, and buses they took, had buses they ran to Grafton and Kempsey.
And what type of apprenticeship did you do?
Oh, it was only one apprenticeship in those days, that was motor mechanics. Nowadays it's separate. You do 1 year on general, and then after that you have to split up whether you want to stay on cars or whether you go on to agricultural stuff or whether you want to go on to industrial and mining stuff. So it's
so that's a four-year apprenticeship?
5-year apprenticeship it was then.
5 years.
Four years at Tech. Was 1 day a fortnight in the boss's time and 1 night a week in your own time.
What vehicles? We're talking 1954.
Yeah, cars they were selling then at Woodard and Perkis were the Vanguard cars, and on the VW agency a bit later too. Then later on they had Chryslers and Mercedes and...
So the Ferguson tractor and Land Rovers, I think, were
were a separate... On the corner, there was a house in between that part of the business on the corner. We were on the corner. And before they took on the Ferguson agent, they had the international agency, and they gave it away and took on the Ferguson agency, which had been held by the co-op, which was a co-op in Armidale, which is a general store and tractor section. But I did remember that he said there was about 100 tractors on order when they took over their business of the tractors. And the first few years I was there, they were selling about 2 tractors a week, about nearly 100 for the year.
So we're talking about the old TE20.
TE20, yes.
That came out in 1946 to 56, so you started your apprenticeship.
It only came out in Australia in 48.
Who is the TE20?
Well, it's the first tractor that Harry Ferguson had built in. Harry Ferguson never built a tractor himself other than one, which they called the Black Tractor, to put his design onto it, and then he had David Brown built them for a while, and then he went over to America and Ford made them, and then he moved back in 46 and after the war and started up. He didn't start the factory, it was owned by the Standard Motor Company. That's why if you look on earlier tractors it says manufactured by the Standard Motor Company. But in the 10 years that they were built in England, there was a bit over 500,000 built, and one in 10 roughly came to Australia, which was a bit over 50,000 came to Australia.
So there's still quite a few around and still going. There's a bit of an enthusiast thing now.
Yes, they are. There are a couple of things for them. One, times they're light enough to put on an ordinary car trail if you've got to take them somewhere. The only thing against them is if you do them all up as look like original, they don't look as nice as the bright red ones and bright green ones when they're only battleship grey virtually.
And they're easy to work on?
Oh, yes, compared with the new ones. I've got three myself. I've got a 48 model and a 49 model and a 53 model diesel.
You said England that there was a plant. Was there? What, is it a Canadian company?
No, Ferguson wasn't.
Massey Harris was.
Massey Harris was, yes.
Basically from 56 we went into a little bit of a period where the FE35 was built.
They were started to make another tractor in America which was very similar to the 35, and then they started to make it in England. They called it the FE35.
That was a four-cylinder Continental motor.
No, it wasn't a Continental motor.
What was it?
It was a standard motor made by this. It's very similar to the T20 diesel, except it had a different type of combustion chamber and cylinder head. No, the Continental motor was what was in the David Brown ones, but the first ones, they didn't have that standard motor built, so they did bring in a Continental engine for the first 2 years.
So that was the going from the TE20 into what we now know as the Massey Ferguson 35 with the three-cylinder diesel.
If they were called a TE20, TE stood for Tractor England, and then when they put the standard motor in them, it became the TA20, and then nearly every other letter of the alphabet depended on whether they were petrol or diesel or narrow or agricultural or industrial and that. So but they added that other letter to them to design what type of motor it was in them.
So just for people listening, the coloration, the T20, as you said, was battleship grey.
Yeah.
The FE35 that came out was golden grey, and
that's
then you
right.
went to the red and grey, which is the Massey Ferguson 35.
That's right. That's when they Massey Harris decided as their tractor. Then that's why it was called.
And they came out in a diesel, a petrol.
And a kerosene,
in Australia, but in England they had a lamp oil one as well.
Lamp oil, yeah.
So the TE20, we're talking back in the 40s into the 50s, it had what, draft control?
That's what Harry Ferguson's idea.
Now what's draft control?
Draft control was a way of controlling the depth of the plough. That was his biggest. It took him many, many years to work this out, because his idea was to mount the implement on the tractor rather than dragging it behind, and using the weight of the implement and the suck of the implement into the ground to give it traction, so you didn't need a heavy tractor to get the traction. But then his problem was, how do you control the depth of it? The easiest way, you put a depth wheel on it, but once you do that you lose the weight transference. So this is what he finally worked out, that the draft of the plough, which is the effort it takes to pull it, hence draft horses, if he could measure that, if it goes in too deep, he could get that somehow or other to make the hydraulics lift it out again. If it ploughed too shallow, he could make it drop down. And that was what draft control was, and that was one of his main inventions.
But that meant that you couldn't lower or implement above the ground?
Could lift it out of the ground, but it'd come all the way up until it automatically shut off. But you couldn't stop it anyway out of the ground.
Yeah.
And that's why they went in the 35s to an extra little cam inside that worked it. It measured where the linkage was and you could stop it.
So that gave us position control.
Position control.
So you had both things, draft both control plus position, control.
Yes, that's right.
And that's the move from the T20 to the 35. All right. So you did some... let's have a look at the training you did. You did lots of schools on...
Every time a new tractor came out or changes on them, we usually went down to Sydney. Occasionally they were done a bit more locally at Coffs Harbour. I went to one, and way up to
Melbourne, I think you went to.
I went to Melbourne on one. Yeah, that was when a major change was done, I think.
Took the train down?
No, I drove all the way, a VW all the way down.
Oh, okay, that's a bit of an experience.
Oh, well, 2 days trip it was.
Now, tell me, you went from Woodward and Perkins. Did they close down and to go when
Williams? No, Haywood Woodward was when I was there. That was his father, but Dick took over then and lost interest in tractors. So that's when he gave the tractors away and Tony Williams took the agency on and he got me to come and work with him.
That was in 1984?
Yes.
It was Tony and his wife running the business?
That's all, yes.
And in the same place it is now?
Yes. They're not selling tractors anymore. They're giving tractors away.
Well, mowers. They didn't do a lot of mowers. Hustler?
Oh, they sell Hustler. But they also make and build these seed drills.
Just for the agricultural seeding?
Anthony was my apprenticeship when he left school. He was came on as my apprentice. And now he's the owner, I suppose.
Now, tell me an interesting story about in the wool boom. There was a lot of tractors being sold.
Yeah, well, that was because wool boom farmers made a lot of money, and of course you had to pay tax on it, so if you could spend it on something, it helped the tax thing. So some people just went a bit mad, I suppose you'd call it, and some of them bought two tractors. But at that time it was the new model 3000 series tractor that came out, and that was the one that was all the computerised stuff on it. It was one of the first tractors with computerised stuff. One computer worked all the fancy transmission, 32 forwards, 32 reverses, on the move, change and all sorts of things, and then another computer to work all the three-point leakage hydraulic system.
You went overseas to have a look at some of the factories while you were employed with Tony.
Yeah, that was when he won the competition in Australia for selling the most tractors. Well, there's more than one dealer in Australia, I think, who got it, but we went over to England and France and looked through the factories. But then we did tours around the other day through both cities, London and France, and we went out touring around in some of the countryside too.
And so you also did some teaching at TAFE. So you went to TAFE to do your apprenticeship, but then when you were with Tony Williams, you also taught at TAFE.
Yeah, most of this was before I went to Tony Williams. They got on to me and said, would you be prepared to teach farm mechanics? And I said, oh, well, what have I got to do? They gave me a pile of books about a foot high and they said, it's all in there. And it covered everything that might happen on a farm. And I had to set the course and write the exam for it too. So that was a fair bit of work other than the time you were teaching. But then I did other teaching of motor maintenance, small motor maintenance.
So you did that small motor maintenance with the kids from TAS and the girls from NEGS. But you tell me that the boys weren't actually that interested in small motor. The girls were.
For two reasons. One was the boys just wanted to get some way of getting out of school, I think, so they decide they join up to that, and they come up with these ideas. They say, I've got to leave early tonight, I've got a lot of homework to do. And I knew damn well they weren't going back to do homework, they were going down the street, but I couldn't stop them. But the girls were brought down in a bus and the bus picked them up to take them back, so they had no choice. But and then I did teach some of them. They weren't kids, they were from University Farm and down at Chiswick. And if they did this course, they could get paid more. So
that's farm machinery, maintenance of windmills, pumps, all that type of stuff?
Yeah, milking machines and everything else, which I knew nothing about, so I had to study up on them and write each week's course, and then I had to set the exams for it too. So
it doesn't surprise me then you've been part of the Institute of Automotive Mechanical Engineering.
Yeah, well, we did a course on that and then the boat came up from Sydney to give us a practical and theory exam on it. And I'm sure at the time they said in any questions on steering and brakes, you had to get 100%. That's better than a doctor has to do, I think.
Yes. So, and you were with the Institute for a long time?
Oh, probably 15 years or more, probably, but it was costing a fair bit. We got a magazine out every month, but it was all on new model cars and all the electronics on new cars and all that, and it was fairly expensive. I probably should have kept on paying for it, but...
So tell me, the church has been a very big part of your life.
Yes, well,
tell me about that.
I always went to this little church, St Nicholas at Somers Ponds, from when I was born, probably before I was born. But then when I moved into town, before I moved into town, I joined the one of the youth groups, and there was two different youth groups. I joined both them, and then when I married and moved to town, I always went to church there, and then I got put on the parish council, and I was on parish council for about 30 years, and then I was a warden there for nearly 20 years, and I still am a member of the Property and Maintenance Committee. There's another chap and I do a lot of the maintenance on light bulbs and leaking taps and everything else that goes on there.
Yep. So just but you're married in 1960.
Yes.
And three kids, two boys and a girl.
Girl, that's right. Yeah.
Your girl's a nurse, and the two boys have got had their profession. They're just about finishing.
Yeah. Well, the oldest
in their 60s.
Yes.
Tell me, fixing things and helping people. Where do you think that came from? That's one of your. I asked you off air what principles you had, and you said fixing things and helping people. Where did that come from?
Well, I think it's because I'm mechanically minded that I like to fix things up.
But also you were born in the post-war period in 1938.
Yeah.
So there wasn't much around then.
No, I
You had to keep things going.
Yes, I don't know whether I had much to do it in the war period doing it, but, you know, Dad used to do a lot. You know, there was no such thing as buying new shoes. You put leather and put new soles on your shoes and all this sort of thing too, see.
But you weren't a wealthy family that you came from.
No, Mum made all my clothes, and I remember in the days, and I've still got some of them at home, as little tickets to buy stuff with.
Like ration cards?
Ration cards, yes. I've still got some of them at home.
They're no good now.
No. Clothes were one of them, but we didn't use them because Mum made our clothes, and butter, tea, sugar, petrol. Petrol went on for quite a while after the war finished too.
But I think growing up in that period, I know with my father, he's in the same age as you are now, is that he was always fixing things because he hated the idea that throwing something away.
Yeah, well, that's my idea, yeah. And that's why I work on old tractors. I can enjoy spending half an hour just cleaning up one bolt, getting the rust off one bolt, which you can't do that when you're working and people are paying you to do it.
And there's a lot of plastic now. When the plastic's broken,
it's
broken.
Yes, yes. But then helping people, I don't know, that probably might come from a Christian belief too, possibly, that I like to help anyone I can.
But your dad, talking about that, your dad's principles were pretty similar. He was involved with a home for the aged in Armidale.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Was it Autumn Lodge?
Yes, Autumn Lodge, yes. He helped establish that. It was only a very small place then. I think it was one little building there. I should remember the name of it too now, but it's memory's failing a little bit.
I will we'll let you off on that, being 87. But maybe that's the thing, you know, fixing things post-war and not coming from a wealthy background, but basically keeping things going. And all your training, geez, a hell of a lot of training with the tech and then teaching people.
Yeah.
But that's helping people as well, you're teaching them.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know,
yeah.
Also, obviously, as you said, the Christian sort of background. And
there's one little thing I realised, that my inquiring mind about mechanical things. So I remember when I was only a kid looking at a model of a ship with it wasn't a sailing ship, it had a propeller. You know, the ones set up on cupboards. And I thought at the time, if the propeller shaft's going down through under the water, how does it stop the water from coming back up through that shaft into the ship?
Oh, you didn't think that there was a seal there? You had to.
I hadn't heard about seals.
Yeah, seals. But those seals are very important. You've just helped me with my FE35, so we know what seals are like.
Yeah.
Well, Rod, look, it's been a great community spotlight. I think we might pull it up there. Thanks very much for coming in. You're part of our community. You're a gem in our community. And thank you for coming in.
Right. Well, thank you, Herb.
And that's Community Spotlight.
Yeah.
If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, great tunes and community news.